Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest today is Bruce M. Beeler. He is a research associate in the Division of Birds at the Museum of Natural History in Washington, D.C., and we're talking about his latest book, Natural Encounters, Biking, Hiking, and Birding Through the Seasons. Bruce, welcome to the show. It's such a pleasure to talk to you again.
Well, thanks, Mark. It's great to be back.
This is one of those books. It's for people who enjoy natural history. It's so much about place and time. And mostly, it is about the nature all around us that, you know, there's an awful lot to look at if you'd only take a moment and look. And that's one of my big takeaways from this book. Would you agree?
Absolutely. It's open your eyes, let the scales fall from your eyes, and actually see what's right in front of you and listen and hear the birds singing, the peepers peeping, all the colors of spring, the colors of fall. There's just so many things out there that bring us joy and, you know, make our days better. And it's all free, thanks to nature. And this book really tries to sell that by telling the story of my experiences over 35 years in the East Coast, D.C. area, Washington, D.C. area, but also taking some field trips to some interesting places, South Florida and northern New Hampshire and places like that, to show that you can sort of basically stage things. So you can do daily nature.
That's right.
You can do weekend nature, and then you can do sort of field trip nature where you go off for a week or 10 days.
What I love most about it is that the observations around the nation's capital, and I think a lot of people hearing the word the nation's capital, the phrase, are going to like start to tense up because so much stuff is going is going on.
Right.
And I'll tell you, it was a tremendous sense of relief to be able to read about other stuff going on around the nation's capital.
Exactly. Let's focus on nature. Those are the things that are going to make our heart rate slow down.
That's right.
Our blood pressure go down, and we're going to feel good about ourselves, and we're going to feel good about the wonderful world that we actually live in.
Now, this is a very personal book. These are your personal observations, and a lot of it's biking. Talk to me about your daily bike route that you would take to work.
One of the great privileges of my working life, I'm now retired, is that I was able for 35 years to able to bike to work.
Oh, man.
It was several offices, five different offices. In each case, I got permission to bicycle year-round. And I live in Bethesda, Maryland. I did back then, too. And I'm able to bike along a greenway, the C&O Canal National Historic Park along the Potomac River. And you're in a green space for like something like 5 miles. And so you're in nature on the way to work, and you're in nature on the way home. And the wonder of that is, you know, going to work, yeah, you might be tensing up a little bit, but you're really sort of, in a nice way, thinking about the work you're going to do that day and what's important and what's not. And then coming home, you get to decompress. If you feel lousy, by the time you get home, you feel great. You've used your muscles. You've seen some nature. You might have, you know, heard some interesting birds. It makes it all okay. So it's really fantastic. Not everyone has that opportunity, of course, but I was lucky enough to have that.
And you were tenacious about bike riding. You would only stop when you really had to, like when there was ice on the pathway.
Exactly. Black ice, that's a problem. If, you know, more than 6 or 7 inches of snow, that's a bit of a problem.
But you did it in the dark.
Otherwise, you know, that's 2 or 3 days a week, two or three days a year that you would really stop you.
And you did it in the dark consistently.
A lot of dark, you know, and daylight savings time. You got to get the lights on your bike, and you have to be prepared to just sort of wing it. And because I was on a C&O Canal towpath, a gravel towpath, in the dark,
wow.
You really can't see where you're going. You're just hoping that you're not going to hit a beaver or a deer. And I never did. I almost hit a beaver once. You can see it looked like a giant black rock, black against black. And of course, beavers have tiny beady eyes. So, you know, no eye shine.
Oh, my God.
I just missed hitting that beaver. It would have been bad for the beaver and bad for me.
Now, one of the books that you refer to throughout your book is a book I've actually read, and I'm going to mispronounce the first name, I think. Louis Halle's. Is it Halle or Halle's?
I don't know. I say Halle, but I really don't know. I should.
And it's a marvelous book that nobody knows about.
Well, you know, I think it was a very popular book. I think it was published in either 47 or 48. And back then, it was just at the beginning of the environmental movement, really. That's when everything began back then. Edwin Waitiel, Hal Borland, Roger Torrey Peterson, Halley, and a few others, you know, Rachel Carson, they were doing their thing, and they were sort of powering up. And the period between 47 and 62, when Silent Spring came out, a lot of great writing took place. And there were, you know, there, I think there was a surprising amount of nature appreciation then. And, of course, it peaked with Earth Day in April 1970.
Right.
And then I think it's really been downhill ever since, believe it or not.
Is this book...
You know, less and less people interested, less and less people engaged. And that's a little bit sad. And that's one of the reasons I wrote this book.
Let's back to Halley's Spring in Washington. There are books, past writings about natural history, that I just wish somebody would do a literature course, and I'm sure they do in some university, that they all they do is read some of the great pieces of environmental literature like this.
That would be wonderful. A lot of them are truly forgotten. You can only get them, in many cases, you know, secondhand on Amazon. And it's there's some remarkable books out there. All the Teal books, for instance.
Yep, yep.
You know, he's got, I think, six or seven books. You know, one of them won the Nobel Prize. Sorry, the Pulitzer Prize, not Nobel Prize. That's north with the spring. But there's a lot out there. And don't forget Rachel Carson. She was a magnificent writer. Basically, everything she wrote was worth reading. Still is worth reading.
It still is worth reading. When I went down my first trips to D.C. To visit my brother in the 80s, there was a book by Claudia Wilds called Finding Birds in the National Capital Area. I remember buying this going like, what could you possibly see in the National Capital Area? And I was amazed. I was absolutely amazed.
Well, her scoping or her assessment of what the National Capital Area included places 3 hours drive.
Yeah, no kidding. Included the Outer Banks.
maybe it's 5.5 hours drive. So she threw in all the good places, and it really is a great book. People are still using it. It's out of print. There was the second printing, but it's out of print and it's still quite usable.
Now, for you, spring. The birding year, the beginning of nature's year, as you call it, is at the end of June. You got to explain that to people.
Sure. There are some people that hate that. Absolutely hate that. You know, people, you know, January, like it or not, is the beginning of the year to some people. And for me, I wanted to start when things were the quietest in terms of reproduction. So basically when the eggs have hatched, the birds are stopping singing, they're taking a rest, they're getting ready to abandon their children, and the adults are headed off somewhere else, the children have to find their way, south for the winter. I think that's when we all go on vacation, July and August, when people head to the beach, take a break. That's sort of so starting slow and working up. I wanted, what I really wanted to do. It's not so much when I started, but I wanted to end in spring, end with that high point. Right? Ending in late December, there's Christmas, but you have a Christmas count. You're out walking in the cold. You see some white-throated sparrows. You don't hear anything. It's pretty gloomy in late December, early January. So
you don't know from gloomy until you've been in central Massachusetts in winter. That's gloom. We're in the snow belt of southern New England. And I totally get that. I love the fact that your book ended in spring. It was like, and not only that, I read it now. So it's spring now. And so there was that great feeling that migration was going on. And as I love that your phrase for spring is nature's most generous gift to the North temperate zone. And man, it is, because it's not just birds. Everything else is out. And I was watching a porcupine today. And
That's so great.
I know. It was. I love porcupines.
I never see a porcupine. I just see them sadly.
Oh, no. As a roadkill.
You know, I saw one in Texas a couple weeks ago. I'm on a big trip right now, and I've seen one on this trip. I'm in Nebraska now, and I saw one in Texas. I was shocked to see a porcupine in Texas. I said,
"It's weird.
What porcupine is doing in Texas?"
Wait, so, seriously, was there a lot of was there a lot of forest around?
Not that I know of.
Wow, because we associate them with mixed forest, and so you always see them climbing up these tall trees, and that's where they're resting during the day.
Sure. That's crazy.
That is crazy.
I'll have to go look at my field guide and make sure I was right.
Well, what else could it be? Well, talk about something you're not going to mistake.
I've seen plenty of dead armadillos, of course, hundreds of those. But anyway, and I had an armadillo in Nebraska. That seems. It was in northern Kansas. That seemed pretty north for me.
That did. That does sound pretty north.
Right at Route 70. It was right south of Route 70. So that's sort of a gauge.
First of all,
I haven't seen any. I'm at Route 80. I haven't seen any after Route 80 yet.
Oh wow. I love stuff, seeing things on their edge of their natural range, so that you
it's fun.
You can. I know.
Well, things are changing.
They are.
Armadillos have been launching. I mean, they've been launching an offensive against our country, and they've been moving northward with an abandon. It's really incredible.
They won't make it to New England because they can't survive the winter.
Probably not.
But we got the birds. I mean, we got in the 1990s. Carolina wren, red-bellied woodpecker, and mute swan, of all things, just totally invaded central Massachusetts.
There you go. Right. Yeah, the southerners. There's Carolinian species.
And it's amazing because I spent one day when I started birding the entire day waiting for a red-bellied woodpecker to come to a feeder in the southern Connecticut River Valley. Now I've got them in my own backyard.
Exactly. And I have friends who have them up in northern, up by Middlebury, Vermont.
Isn't that amazing? Yeah. I mean, that expansion occurred in a wink of an eye.
Yeah.
Now you have a history
longer than you think.
You have a history with red-bellied woodpeckers because when you were a youth, it changed your life.
That was my first bird. That was the first bird I saw in 1958 when the scales literally fell off my eyes and I saw a bird and that was it up in a tree and it changed my life. And God bless that bird. If it wasn't for that bird, I'd probably be in jail right now.
It is a spectacular bird. It's one of those birds, if it's anything's going to cause you to notice the pattern on this back and the red on the head and the whole nine, and it's noisy too.
But now you see, plenty of red bellies come to my suet feeder in Bethesda, Maryland. But now I get pileated, pileated, you might say, coming into the feeder and coming into the suet, and that, of course, overshadows the poor, sad little red belly.
Well, that overshadows everything. That's a pretty dramatic bird to come to your feeder.
I never get tired of seeing that big red crest. Absolutely.
Oh,
fantastic bird.
Now, there's so much other stuff, other wildlife that's mentioned in your book, and a lot of it I'm really jealous of the fact that you live near. And I just want to mention one, and that's the Hercules beetle. First of all, we don't have them
I've
here.
I've always wanted to see that creature. I've seen things like it in New Guinea, but never that particular giant beetle.
And you saw it near Washington, didn't you?
I was just across the river. I was about, 10 minutes drive from my house. Just happened, went across Chain Bridge to the Arlington side of the river and was playing at night with friends, playing tennis outside under the lights. And the lights drew these three giant Hercules beetles in.
Oh, wow.
Actually, four, two females and two males. They were out on a date or something like that. And they came down onto the tennis court. And the tennis players were just terrified of these horrific creatures. They're about, an inch and a half long? Anyway, I rushed over and picked them all up and took them off the court and explained to them that they were being idiots. They're the people that don't like nature, What are you going to do with those people?
I know. And talk about something that's totally harmless.
Harmless. Now, they have a little prickly
on their legs
to hold on to things.
Yeah, and if you get them on your shirt, it's tough to get them off your shirt and stuff like that.
Right, exactly. Yeah. But they're not gonna do you any harm.
One of the things
now, you complain about central Massachusetts. That's the place I'm trying to talk my wife into moving to.
Well, it's
my dream is to move to the Northampton area.
First of all, I should put in a plug. I have a lot of friends in Northampton. It's a pretty special area. Yeah,
me too.
It's a special area.
I would love to move there, but I've not successfully sold my wife on the idea yet. So we're working on it.
First of all, that's west of where we are, and we're in a plateau. Yeah. That's down in the valley. You don't have the bad winters like we do.
Right. You're up high.
Yeah. And you've got the Connecticut River, which is a major migration way.
Yeah. I want to go from the Potomac to the Connecticut. I don't want to miss out on
that. And you're also going to be able to do the Berkshires, which is really special easily on a day trip.
So, yeah. Went to college there, so I have fond memories of the Berkshires. So.
Oh, man, I love birding the Berkshires. Now, reading your book and comparing to what's going around here, one of the things I was most jealous about, mainly just because we don't get them here that often, and they're only just sort of rare southern overshoots, yellow-throated warblers and prothonotory warblers, they're regular for you guys down there.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's two of the three breeding warblers that I have in my within 5 minutes walk of my house. So,
oh, wow.
But they're still special. We don't take them for granted. Maybe the Perula, a little more common. You would maybe start to take that for granted. But prothonotory and yellow-throated, no, they're always still special. And they're never terribly common right there. They're of course common other places, but not right there.
We're going through a massive movement of parallas right now. Like every place you go, there's like five or six parallas right now.
Well, they're adorable, of course.
But they're not. They're an incredibly local, very local to extremely rare breeder in the state. So all the so they're all moving to the north.
I think they like the moss, the Spanish.
Right,
moss
the Usnea.
Usnea moss, whatever it is. Yeah. Right.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is Bruce M. Beeler. He's a research associate at the Division of Birds at the Museum of Natural History in Washington, D.C., and we're talking about his latest book, a totally enjoyable, involving read, Natural Encounters, Biking, Hiking, and Birding Through the Seasons. There's a lot of interesting observations in this book you make, way too many to mention in any one interview. But one of the ones I found most fascinating was about coal mining, which is a disaster.
Yeah.
But two species,
agreed.
Two species may be benefiting from the coal mining. Talk about that.
Isn't that a curiosity? So it's a certain kind of coal mining. This is surface mining. You know, the so-called mountaintop removal that you have in western Maryland and West Virginia and thereabouts, where there seems to be coal seams up on mountaintops. Only geologists know why. And it seems the easier just to take the top off the mountain and you strip the coal out of that. And what happens is the miners, thanks to the EPA and others, have to re-vegetate those areas. So they cover the mines up after they get the coal out, and they put grass, they plant some grass seed, and it sort of comes back as sort of funky grasslands that then sort of very slowly succeeds back to woodland. And when the sort of saplings start growing up around the edges, you get two very special birds that birders like Mark and me I love seeing it. That's golden wing warbler, number one, and Henslow sparrow. Those, for many birders, are high on their wish list of birds to see. They never were very common, but they're certainly much less common.
Well, when I started birding, there were at least a couple of places where you could see golden wings breeding every year. Now,
absolutely.
We have no breeding pairs of golden wing warblers. You should explain why.
Yeah, well, I was in Williamstown back in the 70s. I could find golden wings.
Oh, that's right.
You know, in northwestern Massachusetts.
Yep.
And they are long gone, replaced by blue wing warblers. Well, what's happened is there are two species. There's a more sort of southerly and easterly blue wing warbler, very closely related to the golden wing warbler, which is a more northerly and westerly species. And the two of them in lockstep have shifted their ranges north and west. So whereas golden wing used to, the main stomping grounds of golden wing back in the 60s and 70s was sort of northern or central New England, and now it's on the border, it's moved north and west over to Michigan and Minnesota and into Canada. So, and the blue wing has taken over. So you lose one, you gain another.
And Henslow sparrow is good wherever it is. I mean, that's a great bird. First of all, it's very secretive. It's got one of the hardest calls to listen to. It's like this little cricket sound. It's a rank field bird, and it usually doesn't even tee up to call. It sort of flies about halfway up in the grasses to call. It's a very tough bird no matter where.
And so these recovered strip mines in
Western
Maryland, these birds are basically a lock. in the first week of June, you go up there, they're breeding, and they're singing their heads off. And both, you know, it's funny, they're together. They're, you know, these two very rare species in this this ruined habitat, and quite remarkable. So you really don't know what to think.
One of the towns you give a little shout out in your book, and I was really pleased that you did, Coleraine.
Coleraine, beautiful Coleraine.
I bird Coleraine sort of several times
a
year.
That's up the high country there.
There's a great state forest that bleeds into heath that's up in the northwest corner called Cook State Forest. I always go there to get breeding evening grosbeaks.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Very special. Breeding evening grosbeak in Massachusetts.
Oh, yeah. They breed
that's
in.
That's fantastic.
There's a couple of places. North Quabbin is another one. There's a couple of places in the northern Berkshires.
That's fantastic. I didn't know that.
Yeah, Coleraine. But I'm just so glad you gave a shout out to Coleraine. Yeah, you have friends in Coleraine.
Yeah. My neighbors in Bethesda, moved to the country. They wanted to raise their kids on a farm, and they're doing it. And it's wonderful to be able to visit them.
Now, also another species you talk about, and this is big conversation right now in Massachusetts for the last 5 or 6 years, giant swallowtails. Now, what's the status of giant swallowtails around the D.C. area?
Yes. Not common. I've only had one, and I had one in my backyard that my daughter, Grace, pointed out to me. She was, I think, 5 years old. And you're getting them in Massachusetts now?
That's fantastic. Sheffield, in the extreme southwest corner, all of a sudden they started to appear, and then people were going around, and we were counting like 26 in one little morning.
Oh, my gosh.
And so they haven't...
Well, they like Rutaceae. They like the citrus family. There must be some citrus. I can't remember what the citrus up there would be that they're, you know, that they're laying their caterpillar, putting their eggs on. But that's wonderful news.
It is, and it's very, but it came out of nowhere. It's not like anybody saw them before.
But it does sound like the global warming.
I know.
And it's sort of hard not to think, wow, that's really moving north.
It's really moving
north. Fantastic. Yeah.
Now, a bird that
I think of that as a deep, you know, I think of that Louisiana, down in the bayous, or down in the lower Rio Grande Valley, that's where you see the giant swallowtail. That's where it belongs.
And for people who've never seen one, it really is a giant swallowtail. It's a big butterfly.
Oh, it's a brute.
It
what
is.
A wonderful thing to see.
It's a wild
that's
pattern.
Magnificent.
It's a wild pattern.
It is.
One of the birds that you see often down in the D.C. area that you write about often and just sort of in passing because it's common, we're just starting to get in central Massachusetts, and that's fish crows. They were down. Yeah. They've always been down around the southeastern coastal plain, but now apparently they've followed rivers up, and now we're getting them in downtown Worcester.
Amazing. Yeah. Shocking. They have taken over Bethesda, Maryland, and every mall, they seem to have a particular affinity for malls.
Yep.
They perch on the roofs of the malls, and they call their silent calls. And you say, what the heck? You know, where are the American crows? Why do fish crows like malls? It's so strange.
It really is. Now, we were talking about different signs of the year. For you, what birds would be signs of fall in the D.C. area?
When we go out for the pumpkins, we take the kids out to collect the pumpkins at the end of October out in the fields of Montgomery County, northwest of D.C., what I think of is red-tailed hawks, white-crowned sparrows, and palm warblers, those three. They're sort of moving through the hedgerows, and, you often don't see the white crowns, and you sometimes miss, especially in the fall, the palm warblers, unless you're out on the coast. And those really very much signal Halloween to me. Yeah.
Oh, wow. And so for you, fall is that part of fall is fall going into winter?
Well, yeah, it's sort of fall becoming serious fall as opposed to half-assed fall.
Oh.
In my book, I sort of recognize early fall and real fall. So, the real thing, when you can really, there's a bite in the wind. You can get that northwest wind blowing. You've got a polar fleece pulled up around your neck. You want it to feel like that at the end of October. You don't want it to be 79 degrees,
Now, are there people from the United States government that are out there birding too?
I think there are a lot.
Do they have a formal organization? Like, is there a Senate bird club?
Well, You know, it's interesting. I do one Christmas bird count every year, and it's south of D.C. It's on the Potomac, and it's a count that is managed and owned and created by the Geological Survey. So that's U.S. government, feds all the way. So it's mainly feds and a few former feds. I'm a former fed, and some, you know, occasional NGO person. But it really remarkable. It's all, you know, people who crack rocks, paleontologists and like that, and they love going out birding and doing a bird camp. So there's some of that. You know, there's also a naturalist club that's mainly federal that goes up to an island a little north of northwest D.C. on the Potomac, an island that they own. They have a cabin, and they hang out. They go up there twice in the fall and the spring, and they don't do so much bird watching instead of just hanging out and talking.
I would love to think that there is some birders in the House and Senate that are out there on a regular basis enjoying spring, because that would mean a lot to me if that was.
I think there are. I don't happen to know them, but I suspect there are. You know, every nook and cranny, the birders are there. They may not be showing off, but they're doing their thing.
What's your favorite place to bird in the D.C. area within a radius of 10 miles?
That's a good question. You know, I don't do a lot of birding in D.C. I like to sort of travel out.
Oh, yeah.
And so my favorite place, the one I tell, you know, send people to, is a place called Huntley Meadows.
I've been there.
It's in South Alexandria. You've been there.
Yep.
And not too easy for me to get there. It takes me about an hour to get there, but it's usually worth it. It's a clearing. It used to be some radar facility for, you know, some top secret radar facility, and now it's just it's an open area that's very marshy, and they've had king rails there breeding, and Mississippi kites trying to breed there, and red-headed woodpeckers. It's a beautiful boardwalk over this wetland, and so it's great fun. Anyone can go, even people in a wheelchair can get there. It's accessible, and can be great for warblers this time of year, because it's got some woodland, really nice woodlands. It's a very nice spot.
There's so many interesting places in your book, especially when you start getting out to the Allegheny Plateau and all those other areas in western Maryland and in West Virginia. But we're all out of time, and I hope we've given the audience just a little taste of what this book is about. There's a lot in here. My returning guest tonight is Bruce M. Beeler. He's research associate at the Division of Birds at the Museum of Natural History in Washington, D.C., and we're talking about his latest book, Natural Encounters, Biking, Hiking, and Birding Through the Seasons. It'll get you through the year. Trust me. Bruce, it's been a pleasure as always.
Mark, it's been wonderful. Thanks so much for having me on.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.